accession number 18477, Reel 3.
Hello, Reel 3.
It was in A Troop of A Squadron. And my tank commander was Lieutenant Mickey Farmer.
Why did you admire this chap so much? What was so good about him?
He was very what's the word I'm looking for? He was a man with a lot of feeling for other people's problems. You could go to him with any problem that you had, and he also used to fight for his men. In other words, if one of the lads had a bit of trouble, then he would be there 100% behind him, providing the man was in the right. But I don't think in all the time I knew him I ever saw him lose his temper with anybody. He was the most knowledgeable man that I've ever come across. He knew everything there was to know about a tank, and no matter how good you were at your own job, you could always listen to suggestions from him. And he was he knew exactly what there was ahead and what to do to deal with that. And I say his personality, it just shined right through.
Now, you're at Gloucester Valley, you said.
Yes.
How long did you stay there before you did something else?
Well, when we left Gloucester Valley, of course, we came out. We went down to Busan and then came away from there, you see. That was the end of our tour. And not only that, the war had already finished then.
So, how far was Gloucester Valley from the front line?
Less than a kilometre, I suppose.
So, would you be under fire there?
Well, you'd hear it. You would hear the doing, and although the it was a funny old war, really. Majority of the time, our tanks were static. They were in static positions. And our job was to give them covering fire and protection for the troops that were going in. And you'd always see the troops going through on their way to the front as they went in front of the tanks down in the valley. You know, 1 in 10, 1 in 20, whatever the case may be, or that means that there'd be one person in charge, and like an officer or sergeant, and 20 squaddies, depending on whether they were British or Australian or whatever. They all done their own thing, and they had their own opinions about how many should be in an attacking squad. And you'd see all those going through on their way in, and then if you wanted to, particularly where you turn around and say, oh, there was 10 went out, and he's coming back, you know, and you'd see perhaps only 9 come back, or something like that, you see. So, and of course, on a good day, you could actually see across the valley, and you could actually see the Chinese's holes, a complete. They lived in a whole burrow of holes, like rabbits, across the other side. And you'd have a job to fork them all out, I suppose, really. But I never actually saw a communist all the time I was there, really. I mean, we fired at them and everything like that. We were out there doing, and we've been fired back at. But to actually say that I've actually met one face to face, no, I didn't.
How were the shoots organised?
Well, they come down from headquarters, that we would be asked to give cover and fire, or even smoke coverage to a group going out or something like that, or if they got some information that there was going to be a push by the communists, then we would be asked to give a protection fire squad firing at them. But basically, that's what it was. It was a static warfare, as far as the tanks were concerned, at that particular time.
So these were Centurion Mark III's?
Yes, yeah. And the thing is that although that was our part, especially when the Battle of the Hook came on, then of course we were really busy. We were firing all the time, that sort of thing. But it would be wrong for me to say that we were never under pressure, because we were. But the thing that I think that I will always remember is the fact that we actually, when we went up there, there was these holes, and that's all you could call them, big holes that had been cut into the side of the mound near where the tank was put, or stationary, and that was our home for the time you were up there. And inside there you would have angle iron poked into the sides of the walls, and then another couple of long pieces of angle iron, one that's near the wall and one on the end of the others, strapped up with electrical wire and then crisscrossed over it, and that's where you would sleep on there. And the most dangerous thing that I think we all had was the space heaters inside the... There were all sorts of heating things there, but you'd have a bowl or the top of a 45-gallon tank just laid out on the dunes there. Then you'd have another small bin in there, and a pipe coming out from the outside, and the outside would be a 5 gallon can of petrol, and it would be dripping into that, and you lit this thing up like that. It was quite a good conversion for central heating. Very dangerous though, but it worked.
And so, what do you recollect about the Battle of the Hook?
Not a great deal, really. I can't. I mean, I can. Yes, there was a lot of firing going on, a lot of talking going on the radios. Half of it you couldn't. Well, I mean, I couldn't hear it so much, because, or at least I could hear it. But the with all the commotion going on and the gun firing, you don't get a great deal where I was sat. And there were times, of course, when we weren't in the tank. We were probably down in the doings taking cover downstairs or something like that. But it went on for a good 48 hours, I suppose. But
so there was a bunker down below the tank,
yes,
where you could shelter?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But, I mean, it wasn't much of a shelter. You can understand it. If you could understand the tank, the hill being like that, you would have a piece cut out of the hill for the tank to sit in, or the tank would be hull up, as you might say. And then, and in one case, the there was a place called Elephant House, where the actual tank was underneath or into a piece of the hill that had been cut out. So the tank was actually inside like that. And then there were these bunkers that we used to sit in that were being cut out of the actual hill our side. And that was the place where we used to sleep.
What was this elephant house?
Well, that was what they called it, the elephant house. It was, there's the hill sort of thing, like that. And then there was a piece cut out of it, and it had all been covered up, and then mounds of dirt on the top of that, and the tank was inside it, like that. And it was pointing out towards the enemy.
And what were the problems of firing the Centurion in Korea? Any particular problems?
Well, there's no particular problems at all, no. I think the... the biggest problem was the smack on your ear off. Because those days, we didn't get ear defenders. That's why when I'm talking to you, I can talk to you and... I can't hear you so well as I can learn to read your lips because I'm looking at you. But if you weren't looking at me, I would probably not hear you because of your voice being so soft.
So you were deafened there?
Yes, yes. And I'm not... it was mostly my left ear because that was where the gun was firing from.
You were deafened by your own gun?
Oh, yes, yeah. I'll get a war pension for that.
And how many shells a day might you fire?
Oh, you could be up there 2 or 3 days and never fire a thing. Then the next day you'd fire 10, maybe 20 shots. And of course, you have to clean these things as well. You can't just ignore them. They have to be cleaned as well. So you pick a dull moment and then you clean them. But
how exactly did you clean them?
Oh, you've got the cleaning rods and things like that.
So you're cleaning the barrel?
Yes. It's very, very difficult to... I'm trying to sort of picture it now, as to any sort of one incident that you could turn around and say, well... Yes, I was there, right at this particular moment. But things like Speakman winning the VC, things like that, we had no incidents like that. So there was nothing outstanding that you could recall.
Did you have to manhandle the shells yourself?
Oh, only when you were on that particular duty. If it was your job to put the shells in on... And that particular time, yes, you'd do it. But because it was the ideal tank crew is that everybody should know the other man's job. As I said to you, this is where the camaraderie comes in. If you all work together, that is the prognosis of a good tank crew.
How heavy are the shells?
20, 30 pounds, depending on the size of the shot that you're firing at the time.
What different types of shots?
Well, there's the armour piercing, there's the heavy explosives, things like that.
What types of shell were you mostly using in Korea?
High explosive, I suppose, really, most of the time, I should think. And smoke, of course.
Were there ever any accidents to the crews?
Not that I know of. Certainly not when you get the normal accidents, where people cut their hands and that, or perhaps break their hand doing something or other on the tank itself. But I didn't hear of anybody having accidents or anything like that.
How much danger was there of the enemy hitting the Centurion position?
I think there was every danger. I mean, they had done that before we'd got there. I mean, there had been as far as I know, I can't guarantee that this is true, but I understand that there was one tank that was actually destroyed. But, there could have been two, I don't know. I can only answer for what happened when I was there.
How much anxiety did that create?
What, at the...
of being hit by incoming fire.
How would one feel about the fact of being in a position where you could get hit like that?
Did you feel anxious about it?
I think everybody was anxious every time they had their tour of duty up the front. You can't... I mean, no man is foolish enough to turn around and say, well, I wasn't worried, you know. I mean, that's a fool's way of looking at things. Every man worries about that, whether he likes to show it or not.
Did any enemy shells come near you?
Well, I suppose... two or three times, I suppose, that they've come within sort of striking distance, if you like to call it that. They've fallen within sort of 20 or 30 yards away. I think that was when I was mostly frightened. I think when I was frightened when those sort of things happened, yes.
And how long would your tours be in the front line?
Normally about 2 or 3 weeks at the most, I would think.
So it was rotated?
A month at the most, I should think, the actual tour at the front.
Did you get leave period?
Oh yes, we had the chance of leave. I went to Japan on R&R leave.
What happened then?
Had a good time.
Doing what?
Drinking, enjoying the clubs, and all the normal things that people do.
Who organised that? The British or the Americans?
Oh, no, it was a general thing that everybody should have 7 days at R&R leave, you know.
Was this in Tokyo?
Yes, in Tokyo, yeah. Well, we went to a place called Kure in Japan. And then when we went to, and then of course, we all ended up in Tokyo one way or the other.
How did you get on with the Japanese?
Not too bad, really. I suppose, really, the majority of people that went on R&R leave were looking for female companies and things like that. So, and I'm not going to sit around and say I was any different. But the thing that was always in my mind is disease. So I stayed away from it, really. I had the company, but I left it at that. And that is the truth. I wouldn't... I had more respect for myself and my body than that. After seeing one or two films that they'd shown us before.
What was your attitude towards the enemy in Korea? Did you have an attitude towards...
Well, we'd heard stories, obviously. You heard stories of atrocities that were being done, things like that. I thought I kept an open mind to it, but I didn't like him. I didn't like them at all. And, of course, when the armistice came, like, you know, the end of it came, I was very, very pleased, very relieved. And it was then that I actually I got confirmed in the church, because the chappie that confirmed me was Bishop Cooper, the boat that got captured, remember? And he was one of the first people to be released. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the people that he first confirmed on his first confirmation after he got released.
This is in the Anglican Church?
Yes. And then, of course, not long after that was when we left Korea, and we went to Shandor in Egypt. And it was there, of course, that I hurt my back, and we were only there about 3 months, I suppose, something like that. And of course, we were there because of the Suez confrontation and things like that, you see.
Which year was that?
I remember we were in a boxing match, and the ropes weren't dead tight. I got thrown out of the ring. And I don't honestly and truly remember much after that, because I was unconscious for maybe 2 or 3 days. But I think it was a case of malaria as well as anything else, as well as the falling out of the ring. And before I knew what was happening, when I woke up, I was on my way back, being flown back by air ambulance back to Blighty.
You mean you hurt your back in a boxing match in Egypt?
Yes, yeah, yep.
Boxing for the tank regiment?
Yep. And anyway, I got taken back to Lynham in England, and I was put in an ambulance and taken up to Woolwich Hospital, the Woolwich Military Hospital. Well, I was there for about a month or so in plaster cast, and eventually released. And I went back then from there to Bovington. That's where I was released from the army.
Because of your back?
No, this is very controversial, actually. I don't know whether I should tell this on tape, because I'm pursuing it.
But what had you done to your back?
Well, I can tell you now that we know that for a fact that I had a it all goes down to a disc anyway. I think I'm trying to think of the actual name that they said it on the medical, but it's a prolapsed disc. Of course, since I've been out of the army, I mean, really and truthfully, I suppose, had I gone back to my regiment and got examined properly and everything like that, I would have probably been medically discharged, but I wasn't. And consequently, I've lost a lot of money and a lot of time out of work since I left the army.
So you've had the prolapsed disc ever since?
That's right, yeah. I've had two operations on my back since.
Which year did it happen in Egypt?
1953. Well, 53, 54. That's right, 54 it was, sorry. Because I came out of the army in 55. It was late 54 when I died.
Before this happened, what had you seen of this crisis in Egypt that you were talking about?
Not a great deal, actually. I saw more of it, more of the crisis there when I was out there with the, the Royal Artillery. Saw more of it then when I was in 156 transit camp, things like that. But we did see, I mean, we were on patrols and things like that from Shandor, and there was obviously the contractor. You would obviously see, at night time when you were patrolling the camp on guard duty, you would hear the odd burp of guns or things like that, but there was no actual, we never got involved in any actual conflict while we were there, or at least not while I was there.
Did you say that in 54 you also had malaria?
Well, yes. They. This is when I had the accident in the boxing ring.
Had you got that in Korea or in Egypt?
No, I think it was in Egypt.
How do you feel now about having served in Korea?
I think it was a great opportunity for knowledge of what happens in wartime. It was it's not the sort of thing that I would have wanted to do, but having done it, I was very glad of the experience. I was very glad and honoured, really, to have taken part.